Well, good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, one thing that we certainly know is that air travel today can be a fairly unpleasant experience, certainly at very busy times because they are so busy and because of security concerns. It can mean standing in line for a long time before you even get on the plane. Today's planes can be cramped and uncomfortable because they're obviously trying to get as many people on them as possible. They're rather short on amenities. Now, all those are things that people, I think probably a lot of people would say, well, I could live with all of that if you could tell me the plane would take off on time and arrive on time. And certainly it is true that the airlines are reporting some of the worst on-time performance in recent years. They're reporting that some of the worst performance they have ever had in all of their histories, which leaves a lot of people very frustrated. Well, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about some of what's going on here at the University of Illinois and also other places to try to develop this generation air transportation system, one that would not only make air travel more efficient and reliable, but also make it safer. But our guest is Natasha Nyogi. She is an assistant professor here at the University of Illinois, assistant professor of aerospace engineering. And she is one of a group of people at the U of I's Coordinated Science Lab that are involved in the Center for Distributed Air Transportation Management, which is an effort involving people here at the University of Illinois, which is the lead institution, but also includes researchers from MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and also Cambridge, as well as the FAA, NASA, Boeing, and Lockheed Martin, all of them working together to this end to see how can air transportation be improved, because certainly we know that things aren't going to get any better. We're expecting things could well get worse because we're expecting in the future the volume of air travel just to keep going up. Questions are certainly welcome. If you'd like to give us a call, if you have questions, comments, we're certainly interested in bringing you into the conversation. And if you have a question, I know that Professor Nyogi will do her best to give you an answer. Just a little bit more in terms of background about her. She studied physics and mechanical engineering at McGill University, physics at Cambridge, and also has a PhD in aeronautics and astronautics from MIT. And we're pleased that she could be here on the show with us. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David. It's my pleasure to be on this show.
Let me just also, I failed to give the number if people would like to call in. That's an important piece of information. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, certainly one of the things, I guess it is worth making the point that today, there are a lot of people who fly. The numbers of people passing through the nation's airports, particularly in a few airports, it's even worse than a lot of other places. There are some that are well-known, particularly airports, I think, in New York, that are very, very busy. So the volume is very high, and we also have every reason to expect that in the next 10 or 15 years, that volume is going to increase even more.
Oh, yes, definitely. It's projected by the year 2025 that the air traffic or the number of people flying will have tripled, which will really put a strain on today's current air transportation system, which isn't designed to handle such a large increase in capacity these days. Mm-hmm. As you've mentioned, you know, there are about 64 airports in this nation which handle 85% of all takeoffs and landings. And when you think about it, there's 500 other underutilized airports which are just kind of sitting there, and Urbana-Champaign is one of them, and it's fabulous to go through there because there's no lines and, you know, the security is great. But you go to Chicago O'Hare, which essentially is the second busiest airport in the world, and it's a completely different story, as anyone who's traveling over Christmas is unfortunately going to find out.
Yeah. That's just something I think it's worth mentioning, the fact that since, say, the 50s, you know, air travel has changed, at least in the sense that it was something that not everybody did. It was quite expensive. And now it has become a kind of transportation that's open to a lot more people, and a lot more people fly, and where something that at one time was actually kind of special now is perilously close to taking the bus. It's just that it doesn't travel on the ground. So it is true that it's open to more people. It is a lot more affordable, particularly, you know, depending on where it is that you want to go. But it sounds as if the infrastructure that supports it, the air traffic control system, the airports as they exist, the corridors through which the planes fly, that really hasn't changed very much since the days when the volume was actually a lot lower.
Definitely. The majority of the infrastructure that we're traveling on now went down in the 60s. Chicago O'Hare, for instance, has this weird call signal. If you ever go there, you look at your luggage tag and it's ORD. Mm-hmm. And that goes way back to 1942 when the airport was built as a field for Douglas Aircraft Company, which is the old company that got bought out, of course, eventually by Boeing. And three of the runways which are used are the original runways from 1942, 1943. And it's just the updates have been slow to come simply because it's such a safety-critical system. And people are very hesitant to add things to it for fear it's going to make safety degrade or somehow become more difficult to assure. And this creates a lot of problem because we have a very now conservative system which was designed for a much, much lower capacity where, as you say, aircraft or travel was a luxury item. And now it's a one-day economy. Everyone can just jump on a plane and be in Los Angeles tomorrow. And we expect sorts of service which was never really intended by the sorts of infrastructure that's present today.
Yeah. Well, as I said at the beginning, I think probably certainly people have a lot of things that they will complain about when it comes to flying. But the big thing does have to do with delays, has to do with the fact that the system often just doesn't move on time. I think if you pull away from the gate at the stated time, the airline considers that to be an on-time departure. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, a lot of people have had this experience of sitting in the plane and just sitting on the runway waiting to take off can be for long periods of time. So that's the thing that people are unhappy with. Planes leaving late, planes arriving late. What is the problem? Are there particular things that you can trace to and things that can, unlike weather, things that actually we have some control over that cause this kind of congestion and backup and bad on-time records?
So this essentially relates to an interesting way that the FAA, or the Federal Aviation Administration, meters delay. It counts you as being late or 15 minutes late. Essentially, by the time these little things called blocks, which are these little yellow things which are stops on the wheel of the planes, are taken off or put onto the plane. So as you say, once they take those blocks off, even if you're still at the gate, you're supposedly quote-unquote in flight, which is why airlines pad the flight times for many of their aircraft and simply take the blocks off, pull them away from the gate, and then let them sit. And the real problem, of course, is the number of gates and the number of runways. The ability to take a plane off means you have to have a slot. So the airline has to own a specific time slot where you, an airplane, can take off on a given runway. An airport like Chicago O'Hare essentially has more planes wanting to take off or land than it can normally handle for any given hour during a peak flight time period. There's suggestions to build more runways, but that simply shifts the problem further upstream in the sense that, sure, you'll be able to take these planes off, but there won't be enough air traffic controllers to safely guide them in and out of the terminal region, which is the TRACON area, essentially around the airport. So it's really a problem of capacity. It's either getting more air traffic controllers up there or simply coming up with a completely new way of doing business in the sky.
So there's a lot of demand for flights, so the airlines have tried to respond to that, obviously, by creating flights. They want to make the schedule relatively flexible so people have some choice, and they want to go to a lot of different places. So now we have many, many planes wanting to take off, fly, and land. And a system that has a difficult time dealing with that kind of volume because you only have so many runways and you only have so many air traffic controllers. Some people, I think, maybe would say we've actually reached a point where we can't go beyond. Is that really it, or is it by changing the way that the system is structured, we actually could accommodate more planes or do better with what we've got now?
So essentially, it's forecasted that if we double the amount of air traffic at this present, we'll have complete gridlock. We'll lose $20 billion worth of revenue and, you know, air traffic will sort of grind to a halt. The way we're doing business now essentially is stretched to the maximum. We can maybe squeeze a little bit more performance out of it, but not enough to be scalable in terms of tripling or quadrupling, you know, air traffic into the near future. It really amounts to a different way of doing business. As you say, there are a lot of people who want to go to a lot of destinations. Unfortunately, they all want to fly from Chicago to Los Angeles. Most of the time, they don't want to fly from a small airport like Urbana-Champaign to another small airport like Topeka, Kansas. Mm-hmm. And so there are these major airports, which are the ones which are taking the load. And there are these major aircraft or air traffic corridors, which are having to bear the burden of having, you know, very, very many flights flying through them. And what really needs to happen is instead of being directed along these major corridors, the aircraft have to be allowed to choose their own corridors to fly in, or essentially free flight. They have to pick where they want to fly, perhaps fly around weather delays, perhaps fly a less traveled route, which might be a little bit longer, but which can be less congested, and so they can make up time by perhaps flying faster.
Hmm. Well, what would have to happen? How would things have to be changed if So here now what you're talking about is giving a little bit more discretion to either the pilot or to the airline on the flight path, the way that they're going to go, so which that can either affect their ultimate destination, I suppose, or maybe it just affects the, how it is they get there, rather than there being essentially one road and everybody going on the same road, saying, well, there are a number of different ways to get there. And what we're saying to the airline is to say, well, okay, you can decide how best you want to get there. How do we go from the system that we have now to a system that would allow that kind of thing to happen?
So that is not an easy thing to do at this point. There are certainly a lot of organizations which have a great deal of pull, stakeholders such as the airline companies, the Air Traffic Controllers Union, the pilots, and not to mention corporations which do a great deal of business in these sorts of fields, which run operations at airports. The main idea is sort of looking back almost a little bit. This hub-and-spoke system that we're used to now essentially was an economically devised system by the major airline companies. Back in the day, there used to be a lot more of point-to-point routing. You could go from a relatively small city like Boston to another, well, Boston isn't a small city, but a relatively small city, let's say like Urbana-Champaign to Minneapolis, Minnesota. And there were more of these smaller routes which were available, but they're not economically feasible anymore. So there has to be an incentive to make them economically feasible and thus reduce the loads on the hub airport, which now is Chicago. So if I want to go to Minneapolis, I fly through Chicago or Detroit or one of the other major hubs. And that's one way. And the other way is simply if I'm flying from Los Angeles to Chicago, instead of flying the corridor which has been mapped out traditionally for this flight, can I fly a different corridor? Can I, as you say, go off-road in the sky and try to fly a slightly different route which doesn't involve such careful metering and separation, which means the air traffic controller doesn't have to be quite as devoted to me. He becomes more of a manager, a higher-level kind of guy, and doesn't have to clear every change if I'm a pilot that I'd like to make if I see bad weather coming up.
Mm. But there, I think that, say, there still seems to be a basic safety issue here. We don't want planes running into each other. And that's really what the job of – that's why we have defined corridors, so we know generally where the planes are going to be. Mm-hmm. And that's why we have air traffic control system to make sure that planes aren't running into each other, that they're maintaining a particular distance in between planes. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be part of the problem. That is, that has – you know, it – puts a limit on how many planes you can have in the sky at one time.
So basically the notions we have of self-separation or of separating aircraft and making sure that they're safe harken back again to the 60s and 70s. We're now living in an information age. Our aircraft are much smarter than they used to be. They're able to wander around in an information-rich environment. They're equipped with all these sensors which can figure out how far the nearest aircraft is from it. They're able to plan their own routes. You know, the average aircraft, or at least a Boeing 777, has over 4 million lines of software code on it. So it's a pretty smart plane. And so some of the authority which used to be centralized in a controller because the planes weren't able to figure out what situation they were in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, can be transferred back to the individual aircraft. Decision-making doesn't have to be quite so centralized or rigid anymore, simply because we can take advantage of all of this new information these planes and these pilots are allowed to accrue, and they can make better decisions because they're, as one would say, in the field or in the sky and better capable of knowing what they should want to fly at.
Mm-hmm. I suppose this is something that I would imagine there would be some resistance from the air traffic controllers, since their jobs are involved, and also I'm sure that they would say, look, our job is to make air travel safe, and we think it's important for someone to be watching and for someone to be telling pilots either you can do this or you can't. I'm sure that they're going to say we don't want chaos with pilots and planes deciding they're going to go wherever they want. Can you provide that kind of autonomy to the pilot and at the same time maintain the level of safety of the system?
So that's related to the work we're actually doing in the Coordinated Science Lab on this project. We're looking at generating algorithms which assure this kind of separation. So we're looking at coming up with techniques which will make sure that if two planes get too close to each other, an alarm will go off in each plane, or a resolution or warning will tell one plane to go up, another plane to go down, and many other sorts of nice decision aids. It's more of moving not necessarily from a non-controlled approach, but from a centralized controller to decentralized pilots making their own decisions under the auspices of a manager. So the controller maybe doesn't have as much day-to-day detail over what each of his planes or her planes are doing, but they still manage them. They're still able to step in and say, hey, you two guys are too close together. I need you to move further out. But he doesn't have to monitor every single step or move that the aircraft does make. Mm.
Well, we have a caller here. I'll tell you what, rather than make this person wait, we want to bring him into the conversation as well. Our guest is Natasha Niyogi. She is Assistant Professor of Aerospace Engineering here at the University of Illinois. She works in the Coordinated Science Lab, and she is involved in the program of the Center for Distributed Air Transportation Management, which is an effort that involves researchers here at the U of I, also MIT, Cambridge, people from the FAA, from NASA, from Boeing, Lockheed Martin, where they're all looking at the air transportation system that we have now, how it works, how sometimes it doesn't work, and how perhaps that system could be improved to accommodate what we fully expect to be an even greater number of people flying on airplanes in the future. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller in Urbana right here, line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I have two questions for your guest. One is what she thinks about the regional airport in the Piatone area in Illinois, whether, you know, making these little regional airports will help horrible places like O'Hare. And the other is I recently heard that almost all delays originate because of delays in New York. And last March, I was in New York scheduled to fly out of LaGuardia. They had a storm, which in Illinois terms was minor. There was 2 inches of slush on the ground, and every single New York airport, Newark, LaGuardia, and JFK, closed for the entire day and a half. And I wondered why did that not only that particular time, but why does New York close so easily, and what you think about the regional airport. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right. Well, thank you. This, it seems from a lot of the articles that I've read that people want to pin a lot of the problems of the national system on New York. because it's so busy and because weather can cause problems and so forth, if things get hung up there, it can have ripple effects that can infect the entire country. What's the big problem with the New York airports?
I think New York just makes a wonderful target for the entire nation as well. I too blame all of my air traffic troubles on New York. As they say, there are certain major hubs. As they say, in Chicago is no minor offender as well. I think 1/6 of all delays come from Chicago. I believe closer to 1/3 come from the Eastern Seaboard, which is New York plus Boston. plus I think D.C. as well, but I'm not positive on that. So there are certain offenders. There are airport regions which, if one of the airports or several of the airports either closes or changes its runway pattern, which means a reduced capacity, the entire nation will slowly see the effect of flights just not getting out on time. And this is because of this idea of a hub-and-spoke system. So many of the major hubs are chained together. So you fly perhaps from New York to Chicago, Chicago to Los Angeles. If your flights aren't getting out or if you're not able to make a connection, you have, you know, hordes of people sort of waiting on little stretchers for the next day flight out from Chicago or from New York. And it's just simply because these areas are overtaxed. They're operating above the capacities they were designed for, and they can just no longer take off all the flights or land all the flights that are just scheduled unless the weather is picture perfect. And so, you know, one tiny little bit of snow just means there's a change in wind pattern, which means they have to take a half hour out to reconfigure the runways, have a new takeoff landing pattern. And sometimes it's just easier for them to close while they're going to do that. Or if there's some snow on the ground and they don't want to take the risk of something going wrong, it's easier for them just simply not to have any takeoffs and landings.
One of the things that I believe is true is that if you look at airports that previously had a lot of problems and that in recent years have actually improved some, you could take a look at an airport like O'Hare, for example, or Atlanta, I think that, again, was one that was famous for delays, where recently they've been doing better. And and one of the reasons, I think, is that they have added runways. How much difference can it make having one or two additional runways?
So that actually links back to the first question asked by our caller. There are two reasons why some of these airports are doing better. So Chicago's doing better because the FAA legislated that essentially unless you were a jet aircraft, you couldn't be taking off or landing, at least a commercial aircraft, from Chicago O'Hare Airport. So anyone in Urbana-Champaign might remember those scary little propeller planes which used to come and go. And because of this legislation in 2005, they wanted to, you know, mitigate the amount of traffic flying in. And that helped with the delay situation. Atlanta Hartsfield is slightly different in the sense that it's an airport that is experiencing a lot of delays. It's now actually the busiest airport in America. Chicago has become number two. And that's because they've, again, redesigned how they do their takeoffs and landings. So they've come up with better runway configurations. But another thing that the East Coast does is it does use these small airports which are nearby, in the sense that there are these little airports near Boston or near, for instance, New York, which, you know, like Islip, Long Island Airport, which aren't as overtaxed. And by moving some of their traffic out to these smaller, underutilized airports, they have experienced a little bit of gain or a little bit of reduction in the delays that they do actually see. And adding an extra runway always helps, and places like Atlanta, it certainly helps them if the air traffic controllers in the terminal area aren't already overtaxed. So it becomes, we could add a few more extra runways in Chicago. And there's actually a plan to add four more runways, decommission two, to bring Chicago up to, I think it is a total of eight runways. And that would certainly increase the numbers of takeoffs and landings. But what it would do, it would congest the sky just outside of Chicago, meaning we'd have to hire a great deal more air traffic controllers to carefully ferry them out of this extremely super dense region, is what they're calling it these days.
Yeah. Just, I think that just to stick with the difficulties of the spoken hub system, that certainly has, I suppose, it solves some problems, but it creates others, and that you have odd situations. And I'm actually not exactly sure if such a thing was possible, but that you might, you know, for example, if you were going to fly from Champaign-Urbana to Dallas, you might actually have to fly first to Detroit, which happens to be in the other direction, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But and I think that some people would say maybe one of the things that we could do to relieve congestion and improve service would be to have more point-to-point service. Now, you know, there are a whole lot of issues connected with that as well. But is that some, and I suppose one of the things they would do is indeed if we that might put more planes in the sky, which it just adds to the control issue. But how much do you think things could be improved if in fact, as some people would argue, is that we could operate more smaller planes? They would be more efficient. They could serve those routes where the demand was a little bit less, but we could fly much more direct from where people are to the place that they want to go.
So I can't speak to the financial case that an airline would have to make for it, but certainly from an air traffic control case, I believe this is definitely the way to go. More point-to-point routing. There's this new notion of these very light jets, which are these adorable, well, maybe not adorable if you don't like planes, but these very neat aircraft, which essentially are very affordable and will enable literally small groups of people to get into a plane and fly from Urbana-Champaign to Topeka, Kansas at will. And if they have to talk to an air traffic controller only when they take off and only when they land, then it actually becomes very affordable to the air traffic control system to have many of these little planes zipping around if they can manage their own flight paths once they've cleared their takeoff and landing areas. And this is projected by many people to be the way of the future. Some people say within the next 20 to 40 years, over 60% of all air traffic will go to these smaller jet-like routes.
Let's talk with someone else here. We have a couple of callers here. We'll go next to Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm wondering if this whole situation is hampered by the fact that it's based on a desire to maintain air travel at its current or higher level, as opposed to thinking about other solutions to getting people and information from place to place. We used to have in this country a wonderful rail system. And I can remember taking great trips on rail and through a combination of neglect and influence by the automobile industry and other factors, our rail system is a joke. In addition, there probably are many individuals who will travel long distances for a single meeting that may last maybe 2 hours, and they're spending a very large amount of time and money, when with some thought in terms of the technology that allows individuals to communicate around the world without leaving their office, that could be part of the solution. Are we married to the idea of putting all of our eggs in the airline basket?
Well, I do think good questions.
That both of those are excellent questions. I think there certainly is a little bit of an emphasis on this one-day economy in America. Everything is go, go, go. You need to have it the next day. In defense, I would say when I was in Europe, of course, they have a beautiful rail system all over Europe. But the airline market still, of course, managed to penetrate with those very, very inexpensive 49-pound flights, which took me from London to Amsterdam or London to Paris. So there's a little bit of give and take there for incentivizing people to use a rail system, even if we had a system of the quality and safety of places like Japan or Europe. The same thing with meetings. Certainly there's a great deal of impetus for us to do video conferencing now and not have to fly out all the way to Japan for a six-hour meeting. But again, pushing back from that is the fact that there are some meetings or presumably some interactions which, when taken face-to-face, presumably add some weight to the committedness of the parties. I think it would be difficult to say that these solutions will completely banish this problem. I think they can certainly help with the way we live our lives, certainly, and not overburden ourselves, let alone, you know, taking needless trips or perhaps being a little bit too greedy in the idea of I need to have it right away.
Well, that's it. So obviously, I think the points the caller raises are excellent, and there are a lot of people who would agree, particularly with the idea that it would be, for a variety of reasons, we would be well served by a better rail transportation system. It can be a more comfortable way to travel, more pleasant way to travel, more energy efficient way to travel. You know, for a lot of reasons, nobody's going to argue that. Mm-hmm. But it sounds as if, though, that we still, even if we had that, the burden that we have on air transportation would still be significant. So it couldn't we couldn't just continue to live with the way that the system is, even if we had the other.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I would certainly agree with that. There are certainly countries with excellent rail systems which are experiencing the exact same problems that we are.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just no getting around people's desire to fly, even when the train is a completely viable financial alternative as well as time-wise an alternative.
Yeah. And I suppose we do also, one of the issues here that we have in the United States is some of the distances that we're talking
yes.
about covering, particularly if you're talking about going coast to coast, or even if you're talking about going from, say, Chicago, either to, say, Chicago to New York City or Chicago mm-hmm. to Los Angeles. It's a long way.
Yes. I was just down to New Orleans, and one of my colleagues wanted to take the train. He wanted to take the famous Spirit of New Orleans, and mm-hmm. he did so. And I believe his journey took him the better part of the day. And with delays, my journey took me the better part of the day. But theoretically, my journey was supposed to take me 4.5 hours to his, I believe it was 12.5 hours. Yeah. So there is that.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here. I want to thank a caller and go on to some others. And maybe I should introduce again our guest, Natasha Nyogi. She is Assistant Professor of Aerospace Engineering here at the University of Illinois, and she is one of a number of people here in the Coordinated Science Lab that are involved in the Center for Distributed Air Transportation Management, which is an effort that involves people here from the U of I, which is the lead institution for the center, but also includes researchers from Massachusetts Institute of Technology and Cambridge, as well as the FAA, NASA, and industry partners like Boeing and Lockheed Martin. And the idea of this effort is to look at the next air transport system for the United States, a system that the hope is would be not only more efficient, work better, but would be safer as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a number of callers here that we'd like to bring in, and I think the next is someone in White Heath, line number 2. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I was just calling, and you mentioned Europe. And we've gone over a few times to visit our son and family. And when we get over to London, we can go anywhere in Europe, and I suppose in many other places, for just such a reasonable price. And you go to these little airports, and the travel isn't quite as convenient, but it's so much cheaper and so easy to go anywhere you want to go. And it's from, I don't know what you call it, port to port or hub, not a hub, but they don't have a hub system, I don't think, so much as over here. And I wonder if something like that would work for places. We've had in this local area, they tried to establish a plane out to Las Vegas, and apparently it didn't draw enough people or something. I guess they don't do that anymore, but I wonder why something like that wouldn't work for favorite places where people go, if they could compete with the major airlines and on price and convenience and all that.
Yeah. We were sort of talking mm-hmm. about that before, about,
yes.
about more kind of point-to-point kind of
uh-huh.
Travel and what it would take to mm-hmm. have that be more of a possibility.
Would that be a better solution, or one of the solutions anyway?
That is definitely one of the solutions. As I've mentioned, right now almost 85% of all takeoff and landings are from 64 airports, and there are 500 airports. And, you
uh-huh.
know, we just really need to use these smaller airports in the sense that, you know, I drive down to Bloomington if I want to fly direct to D.C. instead of flying from Champaign to Chicago, Chicago to D.C.
Uh-huh.
And we really need to start getting into the mentality of either having maybe rail links or bus links or some means of transportation, perhaps, which take people away from these overutilized airports and sort of feed them out to these smaller airports and, as you say, make destinations which are perhaps more specified, like, as you say, Las Vegas or, you know, Austin, Texas or something like that, where there's an obvious market.
Uh-huh.
And just get those routes up and flying. The problem is there's an enormous financial case that the major airlines have against reinstituting these kinds of routes. It saves them money to fly you through Chicago, because then if you miss your flight or something, they'll easily get another person on in your seat.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Well, I'm sure there is a reason why this hasn't developed over here, and it mm-hmm. usually has to do with money rather than convenience for the
yes.
customer. So Okay, thanks a lot.
Right, thanks. So really there are two sets of – there are economic issues, which mm-hmm. is a sort of another thing, and there are infrastructure issues as well. There are those two. So you have to – I mean the system has to be able to function. Mm-hmm. And then I suppose there are another sets of issues that the airlines have to confront as well. Can we actually then make money offering those routes even if to offer those routes was an option?
Definitely. And those two issues are actually really inextricably intertwined. You know, you have to incentivize these airlines to change the way they're doing business because they're very used to doing things a certain way right now. And to tell them, well, maybe we'll cut you a break. It'll be cheaper for you to fly from Urbana-Champaign to Topeka, Kansas, because we'll give you a discount on the metering, the number of miles you fly, or we'll discount the cost of fuel or something like that. It's just sort of looking at air transportation from a different perspective in the sense that the stakeholders such as air traffic controllers, pilots, and airlines have to work together with the FAA to come up with the overall solution as opposed to sort of working in isolation and deciding, well, this is what's best for business as opposed to this is what's best for the national air transportation system. It's got to be the airlines who invest in bringing this infrastructure up to date. You know, the FAA won't be able to modernize every single airport on its own or institute every single aircraft has to have a certain type of instrumentation in order to fly. They do need cooperation.
No, I should apologize. An earlier caller, in addition to asking the question about delays caused by New York, raised the issue of the regional airport that's projected for Piatone.
Yes.
And asked this question, well, is that going to help to relieve congestion? Would that, for example, help to ease up things at O'Hare? If that mm-hmm. airport was there at Piatone. It seems to me that's the kind of thing that people argue both
yeah.
ways.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have thoughts about the Piatone airport?
I'm not familiar with the Piatone airport myself, but it reminds me of many other East Coast airports, which I'm a little more familiar with, which mm-hmm. do have these smaller satellite airports, which, as they say, for Boston Logan, they just simply said, we'll just, cut the price of your ticket in half if you fly out, of this tiny airport instead of flying in through Logan. And by that, they have managed to, shift a small body of passengers from Logan to Worcester, which is this tiny airport, which is on the outskirts of Boston. Mm-hmm. But that was an incentive taken from Logan Airport. The commission that runs it, in order to mitigate the massive delays they were experiencing earlier
yeah.
on.
Of course, then again, that creates transportation issues because yeah. then the question is, well, what is your ultimate destination? and how are you going to get to the place that you actually want to go?
Yes.
And in a case like that, it might not be as big of an issue as, for example, though, if you were, you're flying into the Chicago area, but you mm-hmm. end up being at Piatone. Well, it's some ways from Piatone to Chicago.
Yes, there's always that. To look at the other side, it's not as if Chicago O'Hare Airport is in downtown Chicago. You're probably still going to be traveling a little bit
yeah.
from there anyways.
Right. All right. Let's talk with somebody in Algonquin, line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
This is a very, very good topic. The only problem is I see with the whole deal is I know a couple of people who work with the FAA that work at the air traffic controllers. And what they need is less congestion, not more congestion. That's the problem, especially at O'Hare. Their big beef is they've got too many flights coming and going at one time. And I'm sure some of us have at one time or another seen the big screen on CNN when they show, especially this time of year, all the holidays, all the planes, the amount of planes flying. It's just blotted. The whole United States air corridor is basically jammed. I personally would like to see them limit planes, how many can come and go out of O'Hare or any airport, for that matter. There ought to be a limit to how many can come and go, what times they can come and go, because it actually is a traffic jam in air. It's going to, sooner or later we're going to have one go, a couple of mishaps with two planes in the air, and I'm sure it happens, if not already, in the air. I just have concerns about opening things up. I think we need to figure out a way to do the rail bit better than, for instance, the air corridor. And I hate going into airports. I mean, they're just terrible. You wait in lines. They don't have their act together. It's very, very – it's a bad situation. In fact, I have to go out this Sunday. I'm not looking forward to it. In fact, I told my wife the next time I think I'm going to drive. Literally, because it's just, you spend the whole day coming and going in an airport, you know, when you shouldn't, I'd have to do that.
Yeah. Well, I think you raise a couple of really good points. Let me get a response here. And I think, for example, I think that there are some people who argue for the very thing that the caller does, and they would say, we actually ought to set mandatory caps on the number of planes that can land or take off in a given period of time. Now, I don't know how we deal with the increased demand by doing that, but there were some people who would say just that very thing, that we just have to say this many planes and no more.
No, definitely. And that's actually what's just happened at Chicago Airport. And I completely agree with the caller. The air traffic controllers are utterly overburdened. They're having to deal with, you know, over 30 airplanes in any given instant. At peak times, there are more than 5,000 airplanes, you know, flying over the U.S. The decision to cap the number of airplanes in and out of airports is actually being viewed as a solution for the expanding traffic in the East, so in Asia and, you know, India, China, and places like that. And that forces the move actually towards the Airbus-oriented solution, where you have bigger and bigger planes which carry more and more people in order to encompass demands. And that alleviates the problem in the sky, but it's going to make your wait at the airport even worse. Because what will happen is you'll have three of these Airbus 380s coming in, and they will have 1,000 people literally each, and you will have 3,000 people in line at customs. So the idea of using a rail solution certainly will help alleviate some of the burden in shorter routes in America. But there will have to be some means of either making airlines very, very expensive in order to force people to take these rails and incur this extra time burden, as well as there'll have to be a complete overhaul of the safety of the rail system.
Yeah.
At the moment, you know, we do not have the level of safety that Japan or Europe does have on its rail system, so people are a little reluctant to use it. Obviously, the air system, you know, has certain safety concerns, but people perceive it at this time as being much safer. And safety is my bread and butter, and I've done rail analysis and I've done air analysis, and it is actually safer to fly in this country than
really?
Can take a train.
Well, let me ask you something else, because I think another one of these solutions that some people have argued for is congestion pricing, meaning that I'm sure that probably most people, if they had their choice about when they would fly, would probably want to fly around the middle of the day.
Mm-hmm.
They would rather not fly real early in the morning or late at night. So the issue would be, well, you'd say to people, and ultimately say to the airline, that fine, you want to operate a flight that leaves at 10 o'clock in the morning and gets where it's going at 2 o'clock in the afternoon? Great. But it's going to cost you more. And then you'll have to pass that on to your customers so that if they want to fly then, it's going to cost them more rather than if they had to be at the airport at 6 o'clock in the morning or maybe, you know, we're going to fly 9 o'clock at night. Does that make sense?
That actually exists as we speak. If you are attempting to fly out of Urbana-Champaign, next week I'm attempting to fly to London. The flight I bought was the 5:55 in the morning going out because that was the only ticket I could find, which was under literally $1,000. And there is that level of pricing and there is that level of metering. Any aircraft, when it's in the sky, is already being metered. So all en route stations see how long you're flying, what route you're flying, and essentially how long you'll be in their particular sector.
Mm-hmm.
So they do have this pricing system. Unfortunately, all it does is raise our airline prices, and then we're delayed, and we don't actually get there for the nice time of 4 in the afternoon, and we end up getting there at 10 o'clock at night anyways.
So that really, it sounds as if congestion pricing really doesn't do very much about congestion.
It certainly raises revenue. I assume it helps in the sense that there probably would be more attempts to have flights in the afternoon as opposed to the spacing that we have now.
Mm-hmm.
So it does help a little bit with the arranging of airline schedules. I know, for instance, at Indira Gandhi Airport, which is the main airport in Delhi, India, they allow flights in at 2 in the morning, which is one of the ways they're able to cope with their congestion. So they shift their flight landings to much later in the day. It makes the tickets cheaper, and they have a much safer way of taking them off and landing them at a big airport.
Let's talk with someone in Champaign. This is our next caller, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. How much of a factor is congestion at the airports the result of
increase in corporate jets, you know, like Gulfstream is a very popular one.
Okay, so that raises an interesting issue. At the moment, for instance, if you look at Chicago O'Hare, about 64% of the traffic through is commercial, and 33% is what they call air taxi, which are these Gulfstreams which are going in and out. And the interesting thing to note that right now, aircraft are charged based on operation. So if I'm a big plane and I want to do a takeoff, I'm essentially charged the same as if I'm a little plane and I want to do a takeoff.
Hmm.
The only difference in pricing is how long the takeoff takes. So a big plane takes longer to take off, so they are charged a little bit more. But there is something of a war going on between commercial airlines and these air taxis of who pays the most to any airport to maintain the facilities, because right now the commercial airlines feel that, you know, they're being unjustly taxed because they think that, you know, they're paying more of the burden of maintaining these facilities, whilst these small Gulfstream jets don't really have to pay into maintaining infrastructure because, of course, they don't have a hub operating out of a major airport.
Well, do they fly higher? Can they go higher in terms of elevation?
Yes. So, you know, an average 777 will be able to fly up to 32,000 feet. A Gulfstream will probably fly below, you know, 25,000 feet. But it normally doesn't change flight time over much. They don't take as much advantage of jet streams, for instance.
They're also, in terms of, you know, the state of the art, probably even ahead of the airlines, from my understanding, you know, in terms of systems and the whole bit. The main one that I wanted to get to was the, which wasn't raised, you know, energy has become a big thing, mm-hmm. So the waste of energy. So you have planes sitting on the ground. We have a large frequency of flights. And I think, isn't it called load factor? In other words, mm-hmm. How much the plane carries.
Yeah.
So sometimes you got a lot of frequency, but you don't have a high load factor. So, mm-hmm. you know, I think that in some ways, in time, that change in policies and all that has to come about because of wasting of fuel.
Definitely. I've heard there's a recent study which just came out that said an average airline could save about 30% in terms of fuel cost if instead of running their engines on the tarmac, which is, of course, the place where you are when you push off from the gate, but before you get to the runway, instead of running your engines and taxing yourself, you were towed to your particular runway, and then you turned your engines on when you got to the end of your runway and took off. So there is a certain fuel saving that companies are looking into. But again, that would change the policy of how aircraft do business on the ground, because you would want to avoid then collision between two aircraft being towed, which is a bit tricky.
But what about this? Again, you know, all these, and that was raised to a certain degree earlier, you know, the number of flights and supposedly competing airlines and all that is that, you know, it seems to me another big waste, you know, in terms of energy that, you know, the supposed competition, but it ends up that a lot of planes are flying to the same location. The other one, and the final one, is the feeder airlines, I think, which is great. They feed into the large hubs, but that also creates another problem. So, anyway, great program.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We're coming down to the point where we have just a couple of minutes left, and we had somebody who was interested in whether you had some comment about the recent reports that we have heard about, the NASA reports having to do with safety. And you yourself talked about the fact that you had looked at, for example, making comparisons between air safety and rail safety, and the fact that it's safer. Your assessment is that it's actually safer to fly than it is to take the train. But the thing that people might have remembered reading these stories about NASA was looking at things like near mm-hmm. collisions, and ended up trying to bury the report because it looked like there were actually more potential problems or near misses than people were aware of. And supposedly the word was that NASA thought, if people really find out what's going on up there in the skies, they're not going to want to fly. Well, what was your reaction to all of this?
So, yes, so safety is a very tricky thing. How do you measure it? So you can either measure it in terms of accidents or in terms of incidents. And an incident is what you'd call a near miss. Mm-hmm. And actually, every single near miss which is reported, and of course you have to rely on the aircraft to report these near misses, is publicly available. So if you want, you go to www.faa.gov, and you can download every single near miss in the last month. They're forced to make these all available when they're logged. And there are a lot of them. If anyone were to see these enormous databases, and I used them in my research for analysis and finding new algorithms, it is a little bit scary. I guess the difference is for trains, you don't have near misses so much as you have either a collision or no collision possible.
Unfortunately, the point where we almost have to finish. Just real quick, one of the things that I know that you're looking at is this, a new way of doing air traffic control. Mm-hmm. The old way, the way that we're still doing it now, it has to do with keeping track of planes by radar.
Mm-hmm.
The new system, the argument is that by taking advantage of global positioning, it would mm-hmm. actually do a much better job of knowing where planes are. So the traffic controllers will know where they are. The pilots will know where they are. The pilots know where mm-hmm. the other planes are. How much of a difference if we go, and I guess the idea is we will be going to that kind of a system, how much of a difference would that make, particularly in terms of how many planes you can have in the sky at one time?
The difference is enormous. This is the idea of planes being able to separate themselves because they know better where they are than some centralized controller. So this is going to the idea of that decentralized way of planes going from their origin to destination without having to pass through hubs, thereby greatly reducing the number of operations an air traffic controller would have to perform. So that would reduce congestion. And so if all of these aircraft are able to plan their own routes, it's a lot like driving in the sense that you do some off-road driving. The chances of you hitting another off-road vehicle aren't that high. And if you're good at looking around, you can see one coming. So we anticipate that by using these algorithms that we've developed, which are decentralized and take advantage of this global positioning system as well as a whole bunch of other sensors, we'll be able to create this next generation air transportation that will easily be able to handle this threefold or up to a tenfold increase in capacity.
And that would somewhat reduce the burden that an earlier caller was talking about, the burden on the individual air traffic controller having to keep track of so many planes.
It would increase the burden on the pilot because he has to be much more aware of basically his own safety. The burden shifts from the pilot or from the controller ensuring safety to the pilot ensuring safety.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. I'm sure that in the future this is something we could talk about again because it's a complicated subject. But for the moment, we'll have to leave it there with our thanks to Natasha Nyoga. She's Assistant Professor of Aerospace Engineering here at the U of I. She works in the Coordinated Science Lab and is involved with the Center for Distributed Air Transportation Management. Involves people here at the U of I, also MIT, Cambridge, FAA, NASA, and some of the big air industry people like Boeing and Lockheed Martin, all of them looking at the air transport system and how it could be designed to function better. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.